From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. And on this Memorial Day, it's here and now. With just hours to go until the end of the legislative session, Democrats in Texas walked out of the chambers last night, blocking an attempt to pass a restrictive voting bill. The walkout was one of the few avenues left for Democrats. A special session is now scheduled for the fall to complete the vote. And one of the lawmakers who walked out was State Democratic Representative Rafael Anchia. He's chairman of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus and represents Western Dallas County. And Representative, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
This walkout ended a heated Memorial Day weekend debate over this bill because of last-minute changes to the final bill that you only saw on Saturday. You have already indicated that you would, quote, fight like hell against what was already a restrictive bill. What else was added?
Well, they added a really undemocratic provision that would allow a judge to overturn the popular will of an election. And that's something that had never been vetted through that either the House or the Senate. We had never taken testimony on it. It was really extraordinary. So we just thought that in the dead of the night, they dumped this language in there, and we should not let this bill, which was already a bad bill, move forward. And we really told our colleagues in the House that this was wrong. And in the end, needed to shut it down.
The negotiations on this bill happened behind closed doors, but Texas Republicans control both chambers and are basing this bill on allegations of widespread voter fraud in last year's presidential election, which there was no evidence of, as we know. But was last night's walkout purely symbolic? When this bill comes back in a special session, I mean, Democrats will essentially be in the same position.
Well, there's no question, and I'll share with you our strategy for dealing with it. We will fight like hell, because that's all we've got.
What does that mean?
Well, we'll use the rules, we'll use quorum, we will debate, and if Republicans want to call a special session on stripping Texans of their voting rights, we're going to invite Texans to the state capitol to have that discussion, because, and I think thousands, tens of thousands will come. This has been a nationwide effort in furtherance of the big lie that somehow people of color stole this election from Donald Trump. There's no evidence of irregularity in the Texas election. The Texas Secretary of State said that this was a safe, successful, and secure election. And if Republicans want to have a special session on that, I say bring it on. We're ready to have that debate with them, and we're ready to shine a light on the voter suppression that's happening in Texas.
Well, let's parse this out a little bit more and what this potential law will mean for your constituents. Portions of this bill target methods of early voting, like sending out early voting preforms or voting forms preemptively. You and other Democrats say this targets communities of color. You're the chairman of the Mexican-American Caucus. How important are these early voting methods to your caucus and your constituents?
Well, look, early voting is a cornerstone for Texans of all stripes. And it wasn't just African-Americans and Hispanics that came out in droves to testify against this. It was senior citizens. It was the League of Women Voters. It was the disability community who said, this is going to make it harder for our people to vote. And by the way, 24-hour voting, drive-through voting, that was all done during a historic pandemic so that people wouldn't get sick. And now Republicans are saying, no, well, that had the incidence of actually increasing voting, and we don't want that, so we're going to outlaw all those things. The last thing I'd mention, and this is something that hits close to home, is I'm the son of immigrants to this country. You know, my mother left Mexico that had one-party rule for almost 100 years. My dad left fascist Spain after the Civil War, and they came to this country not just for its economy, but because of its highest ideals, because of this democracy that we have that is, as we are noting now, very fragile. So when people try to take away voting rights, like, our family takes it really, really seriously. You better give me a damn good reason why you want to make it harder to vote, and it can't be this big lie, and it can't be pretext, because you will be met with fierce opposition, and that's what we commit going forward.
You mentioned some of the opposition, some of the ways that you plan to fight it. Will Democrats possibly challenge this in the courts?
Oh, there's no question. If a bill passes, and we're going to make sure a bill doesn't pass, but if one passes, we're already working on a court strategy to preserve voting rights. And really, that's been the one place that groups like the one I head, the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus, has had a lot of success. We overturned the illegal gerrymandering of the last decade. We overturned the strict photo ID bill in the federal courts. So we're running dual tracks here. We're gonna have a legislative strategy, and we're gonna have a strategy in the courts.
That's Texas Representative Rafael Anchia, a Democrat representing Western Dallas County and chairman of the Mexican American Legislative Caucus. Representative, thank you so much.
Thank you.
AAA says more than 37 million Americans are traveling this Memorial Day weekend, up 60% from last year when the country was still very much in the grip of the pandemic. But one destination that's still tough to get to is Canada. Its border with the U.S. has been closed to non-essential travel since last March. Let's get an update from Colin Furness. He's an epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Toronto. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And when we had you on the show last month, Canada's numbers were not looking good. There were huge outbreaks in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec. How would you say things are doing now?
Every time we look at the numbers, the winds seem to change, as they have in the United States. I remember the leapfrog between New York and Florida, for example, and we're seeing a bit of that here, too. British Columbia is starting to come down. Quebec, which has always been a big problem for COVID, is actually down. But Manitoba is now by far the worst in the country, and is quite concerning.
What's happening there?
Well, they've got easily the highest rate of new cases per 100,000. So they kind of got caught napping, I think, a little bit of hubris, maybe a little bit of, we've got this in hand, we're okay. I think if you look at their policies, they don't look crazy, but they haven't recognized aerosols, and they haven't changed their policies around aerosols. And I think that's an issue.
And what does it feel like in Canada right now? Are people wearing masks? Are there any public events that people are going to?
We are a pretty compliant country by and large. We're mostly masked up. People are also fed up. We're seeing larger and larger anti-mask protests. And a lot of us find that very disconcerting. It doesn't feel very Canadian, but we also can't ignore it. People are compliant, but tired, stressed, and really hoping for something like normalcy this summer. I think people really need that.
I want to ask you about vaccine rollout. Canadian officials had decided to delay the second dose of vaccine. So in some cases, people would have to wait up to 16 weeks for that second shot, when normally it's 3 to 4 weeks, depending on which vaccine you take. Has the pace of vaccination changed at all in Canada?
It has. It's picked up a lot, and we're now talking about moving up a lot of those 16-week appointments, and that's really good news. I think, you know, at the time that we decided to switch to one dose and try to get a lot of coverage, I worried that that was risky. I understood the logic. The logic is you can drop transmission faster if everyone's partially immune than if a lot of people aren't at all. But there's a risk there that if you have a lot of COVID and a lot of partially immune people, you might be encouraging a new variant, a vaccine-resistant variant to emerge. Not saying that would happen, but it could. And so I've been worried about that. But I think as I watch how this has unrolled, that we have done the right thing. We've brought transmission down with single dose. The opera's not over yet, and we still have a lot of work to do.
So you've changed your position on that.
I changed from being worried about the downside to really being appreciative of the upside. So I think it's a strategy that has worked well.
And yet you're still behind the vaccination rate of your neighbors to the south, the United States. What do you think the main difference has been between those two countries in the way they've rolled out vaccines?
The big thing is we gave up our vaccine manufacturing capability in the great globalization of the 1990s. This is a skill that we decided we didn't need to have. And without having any kind of domestic production capacity, we're very much at the mercy of pharma and contracts and so on and so forth. And we decided that we were going to ink contracts with a large number of suppliers before vaccines were approved. The strategy was, no matter who hits the finish line, we're going to be in on it. But that also meant that we didn't have giant contracts with any particular one. So we knew we were going to be in the line, but we knew we weren't going to be at the front of the line. Perhaps we might be able to find a way where we could buy some of those surplus vaccines off you and speed things up here, because obviously with our giant shared border, we're all best off if we're all vaccinated and all safe.
Well, crossing the border isn't easy. In fact, your Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, says he wants 75% of Canadians vaccinated before the border fully reopens. You know, what point do you think that might happen?
I actually think the biggest risk is not with the U.S. border, it's with everybody else in a sense. We had a horrible third wave that was driven by the U.K. variant that came through travel in November and December. We are seeing now the India variant, which is starting to emerge here through travel right now, and I think we're going to have a big problem with it in the fall. So I think our overall border policy has been weak. Our quarantine policy has been weak. And I can't point to the U.S. border and say that's where the problem is. That said, if we open the border wide before we're ready, we could pay a heavy price. So I think I'm pretty much in agreement with the Prime Minister's suggestion that 75% would be a good safe place from which to start to do that.
Colin Furness is an epidemiologist and an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. Colin, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
When Marvin Gaye's seminal album What's Going On came out in 1971, unemployment was at 6%. People were protesting police brutality, and Americans were angry over the Vietnam War. What's Going On reflected those times with laser-sharp precision and is Motown's biggest commercial success. Well, this year, the album turned 50 years old. And to mark the anniversary, I spoke with Nelson George back in March. He's a music journalist, author, and cultural critic who interviewed Gaye during his lifetime. Many folks might actually be surprised to learn that this album almost wasn't made. Motown founder Berry Gordy was actually afraid it would ruin Gaye's career. In hindsight, that seems kind of hard to believe, but why was there so much pushback from Gordy?
Well, I mean, Motown was not a company that was built on any kind of personal statements. It was the superb production line with producers, a great band, the Funk Brothers, who created pop music for, as they said, the sound of young America. You know, that kind of political, social, personal work was not a signature of the company.
Ronaldo Obias, as he was called, Benson of the Four Tops, actually wrote this song after, during a tour stop in Berkeley, California, he saw a scuffle with police and protesters at this anti-Vietnam War protest. Let's listen to a little of the words. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Nelson, Marvin agreed to record the song, but he removed the question mark at the end of the title. Why did he do that?
It wasn't a question, it was a statement, in a sense, you know, and the record itself tries to actually provide answers. When I say that, I mean to say that spirituality, brotherhood, you know, the oneness of man, ideas that people talked about a lot in the 60s, and quite honestly, is not being talked about enough now in the 21st century. So the album not only illustrates the challenges, but also speaks to what he thinks are solutions. So I don't think you need a question mark for that. It was a statement. What's going on? And here are some of the answers.
Yeah. You know, What's Going On has been used throughout the world in demonstrations against totalitarian regimes, a call for peace in the Middle East. BLM activists played it during protests more recently. It's often played on hand drums at Native American powwows. When did it become clear that Marvin Gaye had this enduring hit that was really bigger than anything that he had ever done before then?
Well, the record, you know, was an immediate success. And it was this, it was a huge cultural moment. So it definitely resonated in its time. But ultimately, the world came back to this album. And I think that's one of the things that happened in the last few years with all the turmoil over race relations, the entire chaos and the fragmentation. People talking about, you know, climate change. Well, climate change, he's talking about the ecology in 1971. These are all ideas and conversations we're having right now in 2021 that Marvin was having. And so the themes of the album have proved to be enduring.
The second song on the album, What's Happening, Brother, was written for Gaye's brother, Frankie, who had just returned from a 3-year tour in Vietnam and was struggling to find a job. Let's listen. Hey, baby, what you know good? I'm just getting back, but you knew I would.
as hell.
When will it be? You know, to put this in context, the American people were learning in 1971 through the Pentagon Papers how the U.S. government, it basically lied to them about the Vietnam War. And this song spoke exactly to the sentiment of hundreds of thousands of Americans impacted by loved ones serving in the war. What do you hear when you listen to this song?
Well, I don't just hear it, I see it. What I'm seeing is, I was a child, I was probably maybe 11 or 12 or 13 in 71. And there were all these brothers in New York who were wearing those jackets, the jackets that you know, Army guys wore when they came back. Mm-hmm. And they were around on the corner. They were scuffling, trying to find work. They were at the barbershop you went to. So you had this return of all these brothers who had been in the war, and they weren't celebrated. You know, there was a lot of protest about the war, so it wasn't like the World War II people where everyone was patting them on the back. So that sense of displacement, disillusionment, the feeling of being used by the government as cannon fodder. That's what when I hear these song, that song in particular, I don't just hear it, I see these people that I remember seeing in the streets, and the song reflects that sense of confusion and sadness.
Mm-hmm. Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology, is a popular one from the album. It was written solely by Gay, and it's a direct truth-telling about the way we impact our environment. Let's listen to a little. Whoa. Nelson, this song rose to number 4 on the Billboard Pop Singles chart and even had a rare appearance for Marvin on the Adult Contemporary charts. You brought up this song a little bit earlier, but you know what always gets me is the end with that haunting soprano voice. What about you? Mm.
The sound of the record embraces many traditions. That was almost like a choral, churchy, even a European churchy thing, not necessarily just a Black churchy thing. So you listen to this record, there's just the inherent spiritual dimension. There's also this jazz thing that's constantly flowing through the percussion, and how percussion plays a huge part in the flow of this particular song and the entire album. So by layering in organically so many different kinds of music, you create an environment that is very distinctive. This album really changed Marvin's career.
You interviewed Marvin Gaye a few times, but there's the time in March of 1983, a year before he was killed by his father. And you were met with a man who was different than what you expected him to be. He was a visibly broken man. And you wrote this highly regarded but very haunting piece. All these years later, do you interpret that interview and the man before you any differently?
Well, no, I mean, that was a moment, you know, he was coming back from his kind of self-imposed exile in Europe. When he came back to the States, he was on a high. He, you know, sexual healing was coming out and he was sort of on a comeback. But he also was confronting his old demons, demons of drug abuse, demons of very fraught family relations, demons of his own sexual issues that he was dealing with. And so I feel like there's a sense of, I don't know, you know, melancholy. When I sat with him, I asked him about what's going on and whether or not the time called for another album like that. And he was very reluctant to sort of embrace that idea. He said it took a lot of soul searching, a lot of meditation. So he wasn't in whatever space that had created what's going on had passed for him. He had moved away from the social commentary that what's going on represented. And I think it's because he spiritually didn't feel connected both to the U.S. in the same way and even to some parts of his own views.
We asked some of our listeners what this album means to them, especially now during the pandemic and with so much pain and suffering. And Jonathan Grunert of Rochester, New York, told us he first heard What's Going On as he worked his way through his college CD library almost 20 years ago. He's 38 now and makes a point of listening to the album every year.
Most recently, I've listened to it as I drove to Rochester for Black Lives Matter demonstrations around the 2020 murder of Daniel Prude, pointing out to my kids that this album, nearly 50 years old, is still very relevant and very real, and a cry for help, healing, and understanding in the face of unspeakable violence.
Nelson, it's been 50 years since this album debuted. What does it mean to you?
Well, it's just, to me, a beautiful piece of art. Inner City Blues haunts me. There's something about the production and sound of it. I mean, you can put that music over any city scene in any urban center in the last 50 years, and that music would work. Mm-hmm. The descriptions in it, the atmosphere of the record, his vocal stylings, it would still feel like he's describing right now.
Music journalist, author, filmmaker, and cultural critic Nelson George, thank you so much for going down memory lane with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This album means a lot to a lot of you. Here's some of what else you all had to say. Charles Townsend, 62, of New York City, says, "It was the first album I bought with my own money as a church kid. It was the first popular music I heard that was both spiritual and secular, that I could dance to, and it made it practically divine. I had to have it." Chelsea Crabb of Somerville, Massachusetts, says she's always loved Marvin Gaye since she was a kid, but now at 26 years old, she says, "I finally know what Marvin Gaye's lyrics really mean and really meant. I finally know what he was singing about, pleading for, exactly 50 years ago, the cyclical patterns of history writing itself in another repeat measure right on time." Thanks to all of you who sent in messages going down memory lane with us, the 50th anniversary year of Marvin Gaye's seminal album, What's Going On. This is Here and Now. This ain't living, this ain't living. No, no, baby, this ain't living. No, 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 no. Inflation, no chance to
An officer pins a 16-year-old to the ground and punches out his teeth. But are there any consequences for the cop? For the first time, we take you inside the secret investigations that show how police protections in California shield officers from accountability. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
The central tenets of the far-right conspiracy theory QAnon are now as accepted in the U.S. as some major religions. A new poll finds that about 15% of Americans believe the government and media are controlled by Satan-worshipping pedophiles running a child sex trafficking ring. Same for the claim that true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. Robert Jones is CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. It's the group that conducted the poll. Robert, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going through your head when you start crunching these numbers and you start to see these trends emerge?
Well, it's deeply troubling. You know, I should say, as a social scientist, the question you read a minute ago is one I never thought I would write. But here we are, you know, and so we've been trying to measure this, you know, QAnon, which is kind of a big tent conspiracy theory. And even when we ask very specific questions, you know, you read one about the presence of evil and control. It also had a component of apocalyptic thinking, that there's a storm coming that'll sweep away elites in power. And then, as you also read, a justification of violence, most troublingly. And then we find 15% of Americans, that's 30 million people. You know, and if it were a religion, it would rival the size, for example, of white evangelical Protestants or white mainline Protestants, very mainstream religions in the country today. And it gets more concerning if we focus on political conservatives, that if we look at Republicans or white evangelical Protestants, for example, these numbers rise to 1 in 4.
And is that who these people are most likely to be?
You know, it is. It tends to be political conservatives. So Republicans are much more likely than Democrats. White evangelicals, members of the Church of Jesus Christ or Latter-day Saints or the Mormons, and interesting Latino Protestants as well. These are all groups that supported President Trump. You know, this kind of proto-religious conspiracy movement, it isn't a laughable fringe movement. But it's now really an animating core of both white political and religious conservatism.
And can your poll explain how it is that we got to this point?
these kinds of conspiracy theories thrive when there's been a great social upheaval, right? And the country has changed as it has over the last decade, demographically, religiously. For example, the country has moved from being majority white Christian country to one that's no longer white and Christian. And I think this is one of the things that sort of sets the table for people to kind of cling to these fantastical claims when they feel like the ground is shifting out from under them.
Hmm. QAnon, as I'm sure you know, can be tough to poll. I mean, we've seen people just flat out lying to pollsters over the last election cycle. How confident are you that you've accurately captured a representative sample of America?
Yeah, thanks. That's an important question. So a few things. One, this is a very large poll. It's over 5,000 interviews. It's a random probability sample as well. So everyone in the country, in theory, has an equal chance of being in this survey. And third, it was conducted online and anonymously, not with a human interviewer, which sometimes introduces bias on questions like these. And then finally, we asked very, very specific questions, and not just one, but three. And all three of them correlated quite tightly together. So when you get these kinds of very specific questions, and then they do reflect kind of what you see in reality, it gives you a high degree of confidence that you've captured something real.
We're going to link people to the poll at hereandnow.org. Robert Jones, head of the Public Religion Research Institute, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, the city of Tulsa commemorates the 100th anniversary of the 1921 race massacre, in which a white mob descended on the prosperous black neighborhood of Greenwood, burning and looting 35 city blocks and killing at least 300 people. Historians say we will likely never know the exact number of those killed. The neighborhood was known as Black Wall Street because of its many thriving black-owned businesses and homeowners and residents. In a testimony before Congress, 106-year-old Greenwood survivor Lessie Benningfield Randall told what happened.
They burned houses and businesses. They just took what they wanted. Then they burned the building. They murdered people. We were told they just dumped their dead bodies into the river.
In a recent episode of NPR's Code Switch, Shireen Marisol Meraji and Karen Grisby Bates share what the neighborhood is like today. Here's an excerpt of that podcast. And a warning, Karen uses the N-word at one point in the conversation, though it has been bleeped.
Greenwood itself is pretty intimate, Shireen. Everything is just a short walk from everything else, which is nice. There are a couple of three-story brick buildings, which are basically all that remains of the 1920s Black Wall Street, and even those were rebuilt right after the massacre. There's a couple small restaurants, a bail bonds outfit, a holistic health store. Around the corner is 1OK, a new minor league baseball field, and down the street, towering over everything, is the metal skeleton of Greenwood Rising. That new museum we were talking about earlier, which is supposed to open sometime soon. And right on the edge of the neighborhood are a set of train tracks. Railroad tracks still divide Greenwood from the rest of the city, and now they've added highways. Urban renewal, which some people sardonically call urban removal, has slashed through a lot of residential Greenwood. Courtesy of eminent domain, and so it's been sectioned off even more. So this little island of black culture and wealth that existed 100 years ago is really fighting to hang on. And we don't know how that's going to turn out because there are other interests, private investors, both from here and abroad, who see this as a very lucrative proposition.
So let me get this straight. 100 years ago, you had those train tracks, they were there, and they were the dividing line between black and white Tulsa. And now Greenwood has been chopped up even further and subdivided thanks to freeways and highways. Even more recently, parts of Greenwood are being bought up by various investors.
And this, Shireen, is why many longtime Greenwood families are so frustrated. They worry that soon there won't be much left of old Greenwood.
I feel like it's gone. Yeah, I feel like it's gone.
Nehemiah Frank is the owner, publisher, and editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times, a digital newspaper that takes a critical look at Greenwood's equity issues.
My family, they own businesses on Black Wall Street. They own real estate in Black Wall Street.
But Nehemiah says that so many of the families that wanted to stay in Greenwood couldn't rebuild their homes there.
Hmm.
After the massacre, the city passed new safety and zoning laws that purposely made rebuilding there prohibitively expensive. In fact, an editorial in the Tulsa Tribune back in the day called It Must Not Be Again argued in no uncertain terms that, quote, town, unquote, must never be allowed in Tulsa again.
Wow.
I like to call it the dry massacre, right? Without the bullets and the bombs and the mob. It was a massacre by, you know, legislation. That's what that was.
Now Nehemiah thinks the only way to make things right by Tulsa's Black community would be for the city to offer up some form of reparations. Zero taxes for residents of Greenwood. Housing grants. Business grants. Because even for people who live in or near Greenwood, the obstacles to owning a business there are still enormous.
I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones, you know, because people believed in, you know, the mission of the Black Wall Street Times. So they, you know, they helped fund us. They bought ads. They participated in events. You know, I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones that gets to have a business.
Reparations has been a constant theme in our episodes lately. But it's not just Nehemiah who is asking for monetary repair for what went down. The survivors and descendants who spoke to Congress did too, like Mother Randall.
Yep, and Nehemiah wasn't the only one who brought that up while we were in Tulsa, Shereen.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the people we interviewed said the same thing. But Nehemiah told me that ahead of this centennial, he expected many people in Tulsa to paint a vastly sunnier picture of where the city has arrived. And he warned us not to buy that version.
You're going to hear a lot of kumbaya. You're going to hear people saying that Tulsa is, you know, at the forefront of race relations and, you know, race reconciliation in the country. And that is the farthest from the truth. And it'll remain, you know, being the farthest from the truth until the white leaders in this city face their own histories.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning here that Mother Randall, Leslie Benningfield Randall, the woman who testified before Congress, she has been frustrated as well.
Yeah.
She recently sent the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, which is responsible for the new Greenwood Rising Museum, she sent them a cease and desist letter asking them to stop referencing her as if she supports this work. And I'm just going to read a part of her statement. It says, quote, "My family and I are shocked to hear that the commission is dedicating much of their work to me, since they have refused to meet with me, did not allow me an opportunity to participate in the commission's planning, and declined to enter discussions on how I, a living survivor of the massacre, feel about their activities around the centennial." So yeah, some people are less than thrilled with what's going on.
Yeah, and Shereen, we reached out to the Centennial Commission to see if they had any comment about what Mrs. Randall had said, and I haven't heard back from them yet, so stay tuned.
That was Karen Grisby Bates and Shereen Marisol Meraji. You can hear the rest of this episode on the Tulsa Massacre on NPR's Code Switch podcast. And tomorrow, President Biden is expected to visit Tulsa as part of 3 days of commemoration. An event called Remember and Rise, which had originally been scheduled for today, was canceled because of increasing financial demands.
Well, a lot of people are daydreaming about the future now that states are lifting pandemic restrictions and the vaccination rate creeps up higher and higher. We asked people what they're most looking forward to doing once they're fully vaccinated, and here's what a few of our listeners told us.
My name is Margaret Doho, and I am 27 years old, and I live in Lowell, Massachusetts. I'm fully vaccinated as of right now, and one thing that I'm really looking forward to is traveling outside the country, especially to visit my family who are in Kenya, something that I didn't get to do last year. So I'm definitely looking to doing that this year.
My name is Rebecca Walston. I'm 44 years old from Austin, Texas. I am already fully vaccinated, and I'm real excited to go see live music again. Live music's always been a big part of our lives as a family, so we're excited to be able to get to do it again. We miss South by Southwest and so many concerts. It'll be weird not wearing a mask, but we're going to have a blast.
I'm Karen Dunham. I'm 64 years old, and I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I am fully vaccinated. I had the Johnson & Johnson one shot and done on March 15th. And I am looking forward to returning to my avocation, calling square and contra dances for private parties, high school proms, and dance communities. Contra dancing is a form of traditional dance that developed centuries ago, and it's very similar to square dancing, and it's been on hold for the last year plus.
We're crossing our fingers that Karen Dunham can get back to the dance floor soon there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We also heard from Rebecca Walston of Austin, Texas, and Margaret Ndoho from Lowell, Massachusetts, all of them telling us what they're looking forward to doing now that the pandemic is easing and they're fully vaccinated. If you've got plans, let us know. We're at hereandnow.org.
It was a miserable Saturday morning on Cape Cod. Howling wind, pelting rain.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning. Any section you want to go to, go right ahead.
But all that bad weather didn't stop hundreds of volunteers from coming to the Massachusetts National Cemetery to place flags on every single grave, all 80,000 of them. The effort is called Operation Flags for Vets, and it was started by Massachusetts resident Paul Monty after his son Jared was killed in Afghanistan. 10 years ago, Paul drove his son's old Dodge truck to the first Operation Flags for Vets. And it was an interview we aired about Paul in 2011 that inspired the hit country song, I Drive Your Truck. Well, Paul's still driving that truck, and Here and Now's Alex Ashlock spoke with him again this Saturday at the cemetery.
Did you ever think 10 years ago in 2011 that this event would end up being what it is?
Not in my wildest dreams, no. We thought originally we'd have 5 years and then military might take it over. And here we are in 10 years and they're not taking it over. We're doing it. No.
It's and a it's labor of
love, you know.
It's a miserable morning, rainy, windy, but people are still showing up.
Yeah, it's a testament really to those people that we never hear from. They come down here and do something good out of the goodness of their own heart, and all they get is a thank you. But as you can see them coming in, you know, they're very happy to be here. What can we do? How can we help? And that's what makes my heart warm, is that it's just the ordinary American citizen that's here and then, you know, bringing their kids and teaching their kids about, you know, why America's free and what it's all about. That's the great thing.
I know you've always said it's not, or it never really was, about Jared.
No, no. Jared loved his soldiers. They were prime in his mind. It was them and their welfare and how they went. So, you know, when I started this and they put one flag on his grave, it made me so angry because he would have been screaming. No, these are all the guys that deserve something. And that's why I pushed on and made sure that we could do every grave in here. Now doing, you know, almost 77,000 graves, and every year it's increasing in numbers. But, yeah. It's not about Jared, though. It's a testament to him, to honor those guys he loved. But no, it's not about him.
I think you started with something like 50,000 graves here, 50,000 flags. You've obviously, over 10 years, had to replace flags. People donate money so you can buy the new flags.
And we just purchased 80,000 new flags. We don't get any government support. There's no discount for what we're doing. We don't get any corporate support. it's again the person sitting in that house that doesn't do much, that writes a check for $10, or the little kid that comes up with a jar full of coins that he collected all year long and says, can I buy some flags? And that's what keeps us going.
We're standing by the truck. The engine is running because I know you have probably had the heater on when you were sitting inside. How's the truck running?
It's running really well. I actually went out and bought another vehicle so that I don't have to use it every single day. And, you know, it's kind of giving it a break. It does get on the road at least once a week, you know, to keep it going. But it's running really well. We just replaced the brakes in it, but, you know.
And you started driving it, obviously, after Jared was killed in Afghanistan. What do you think about, or do you still think about him every time you drive it?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's with me in there. That's why, you know, it's getting a little messy because I refuse to vacuum it because his DNA is all over it, you know? And I want to thank you, too, because it was because of you that song was written. Had you not done that interview... You know.
And we're still, I think both of us are still waiting for some royalties.
Royalties, what are those? No. We don't get anything from the song. Nothing at all. But that's okay.
That was Paul Monty speaking with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock at the Massachusetts National Cemetery this past Saturday.
$0.89 in the ashtray, half-empty bottle of Gatorade rolling in the floorboard. That dirty Braves cap on the dash, dog tags hanging from the rear view, old skull can and cowboy boots and a gold army shirt.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.
All right. People got their ways of coping. Oh, and I got mine. I drive your train.